the planning order of the members.
We are continuing with the mission that started yesterday, and it deals with the overview of that department, so that the Committee on Transport of the Fourth Parliament can have a clear understanding of what the department is all about. And secondly, we moved to deal with the budget vote related matters. We had presentations, and we are going today to get into discussion of the presentation. I know that there are outstanding questions from last week's presentation as well as yesterday's presentation. We will approach this with the understanding that we don't have the whole day. We were planning to have our meeting threshing to 1 o'clock. The programming committee and the house chair, together with the chief whip, have given us permission to sit between now and 10, and then break, go to the house, because there are budget votes, debates that are taking place that all members are expected to attend. And then after that, we will come back between 12:30 and 2, meaning that we will have a waiting lunch. I don't know how we will arrange that. So if we are conscious about time, and also not to ask the question that has already been asked, we may make up on the time. We may finish our program within the available time, and it would really assist us in preparing for our budget vote debate, which takes place on the 3rd. Thank you very much. I will now take questions. What I'm going to do, we will take 5 questions at a time. And if a member has asked 2 questions, we must then take that into consideration, that the member has asked 2 questions, and therefore we will not take the 5 hands if there were 5 hands that were raised. Thank you. We start with the Honourable Farm.
Thank you, Chairperson. And good morning to you all. So I could just go back to the question I tried to pose yesterday relating to the organogram and the issues related to that, and specifically the vast improvement from the 40% plus minus vacancy rate that existed in the previous financial year to the 9% that they're reflecting now in the report. And maybe the DG can just sort of enlighten us whether that includes, as she quite rightly was indicating, the acting positions that are sitting there, or whether they're full-time positions, or whether it does actually also include in that calculation the posts that have not been funded. So that was the first question, just to get clarity on that aspect of it. Madam Chair, you spoke about this master plan yesterday, which I'm aware the department is working on. But one of the things and the initiatives I think this committee must look at very seriously is the problem trying to get that plan together, because of the involvement of every other entity in government, just about. It's cross-cuts across the Department of Transport. I mean, for a start, you know, we sit here and we every year talk about trying to get rail to be the main media or medium of travel for a lot of the traditional bulk transport that is currently being run by road. And our roads are deteriorating at such a fast rate, and yet we have hardly any impact other than the logistical sort of planning processes that take place between them in the department and Transnet, who actually run the freight rail. Now, you know, transport is rail. We must accept that. And how do we get to a point where we can actually have some control over that entity in terms of part and parcel of a seamless travel between ports, between the airports, and between the road traffic that is taking place on our roads, to ensure that this integration that we talk about every year takes place. Now, I don't know whether you know, any discussions at any high level have taken place with ministers in public enterprises to try and see how that can take, you know, can effectively be managed. We used to, in this committee, when I first came here, have insight and oversight on SAA and, you know, even on some of the Spoornet aspects and Fortnet aspects. We now have a regulator which actually overrides or overarches on that particular thing, which is vested in this department. But it doesn't have anything to do with the actual operations on the ground. You can't get a container out of Durban and put it on a train to get it effectively into Johannesburg because of the bottlenecks that are created there. And how does it now impact on this master plan? I'm just putting this down as an issue because we have to talk about that and we have to address it. The other thing, did you say we're going to have five questions sort of each or five hands?
No. I said we'll take five questions at a time, but if a member has asked the two questions, then the second hand, or people cannot expect that we will take the five hands at one go.
So you must rule now, and then I'll come around for another round of questions because I don't want to dominate, but there's a lot of questions I have and I have to leave here for
That is because you are also a returning member, and the approach that I would want us to take is that so that you also give other members an opportunity to ask questions, would be maybe when a question is asked, if you have anything to add on that, then you add, so that we can also gain from your experience of having served in the committee. But if you ask all the questions, then we will not get an understanding of how other members are getting on with their understanding the work. So let's do that. Give backup information rather than asking all the questions. Honorable Chief Reiter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first I wanted to ask is part of the presentation yesterday was the fact that Gautrain, a rail link, will be integrated into the holistic plan. My question is, what is the plan in this regard? Because the tracks on the Gautrain are different from all other rail. How would that work? And how, when you say integration, what is that understanding? Because in my mind, I have a different understanding of the integration, of what integration you mean. And then also part of your presentation yesterday, you mentioned that there was an over expenditure where there was some losses against a claim for injuries sustained in a motor vehicle accident. If you could just unpack what that was about, because my colleague did mention surely that would go through the road accident fund, so maybe perhaps you could just unpack that. I have questions, but I'll go through on the next round. Thank you, Archie.
Mm-hmm. Honorable Ngele.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry I'm going to be a thorn on your neck, especially with women and the rural areas. Those are my areas. Talk of the rural areas, I'm a rural area person. I know what they need. I know what the problems are. Like this Shobagan, is this Shobagan Male or Shobaganula? It's quite a wonderful project, really, because these kids walk. But now, their walking, it is different because there are no roads. Some have to cross the rivers without bridges, you see. Some have to climb mountains, which is very difficult. How are you going to manage that? This Shobakalula. And one other question will be, somebody spoke about accidents, road accidents. I don't want to believe, and I don't understand two trains colliding. Because each train has its own railway line and the other one. But it is so common these days, go to Tshwane, where those accidents happen. How does that happen? Is it the carelessness to drivers, or I just, what are those people called? The Shandela people who Shandela the trains, I don't know what how to put it. But that is a mess, really. The carelessness somewhere. Can you please explain? I'm going to take two references.
Can we take an honorable vote later, because we already have six questions.
Okay.
Can we now hand over to the department to respond to the questions, starting with the questions from Honorable Faro.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Thank you again for the questions that have been put to us. I would propose a particular approach to responding to questions. We'll try and really be brief if the questions are straightforward. I would suggest that on others we'll also indicate if detailed information is required, that we can provide it in written form and submit it back to the committee. We haven't had such a question yet, but in case it comes up later. And then I'd also like to refer certain questions to other members of the department, specifically because they've been assigned to deal with those members, with those questions as we go through. Firstly, Honorable Chairperson, with respect to the issue of the organogram and the issue of the staff establishment, the challenge that we raised previously with the former committee around the 40% vacancy, just for background for new members, was as a result of a very extensive restructuring exercise, which grew the department from 3 branches to 9 branches. And by definition, that growth would have grown the department to over 1,000 members of staff. We submitted that proposal to National Treasury. In fact, that proposal was submitted to the Department of Public Service and Administration first, which approved it, and then it was submitted to National Treasury for financing. The National Treasury response was quite simply that it was appropriate to proceed with such an organizational structure, but that it could not be financed. Effectively, it was a substantial increase that could not be financed in a single financial year. We then agreed on a phased approach, and that phased approach principally indicated how the department would be filled on the basis of annual allocations and increases at the beginning of every financial year. So yes, indeed, that results in a 40% vacancy rate, because a lot of those posts are actually new posts that have been newly established in that restructuring exercise, and we proceed with the process to fill them. That particular vacancy rate of 40% did include acting positions. The current vacancy rate of 9% also includes acting positions, which would mean where we have an acting position, we're not pretending to have filled the post. The actual established post is still considered as vacant. But as the Public Service Act requires, all vacant positions are, or against all vacant positions, you appoint people to act. What is not included in that 9% rate is actually the unfunded post. Because principally, the idea of an organizational establishment which is not funded, I think in our view remains still largely a proposal. A formally established organizational establishment is one that is funded. In the period between the said time at which 40% was the vacancy rate of this department and now, we have embarked on an extensive recruitment drive that filled a lot of positions in the department which have helped us to reduce the vacancy rate substantially. The vacancy rate indeed has been significantly reduced to those levels of 9% currently, because we have fast-tracked the process of recruitment. We came to the former committee also to describe the measures we had adopted, which include fast-tracking the recruitment process and cutting short the period, adding capacity in the department to process posts and applications. Chairperson, I think it is worthy to note that whenever we get an application on an advertisement out in the press for a post of, for instance, security or head of security, we get anything in the region of about 500 applications at a given time. There's a lot of unemployment out there. And the reality is that created a capacity blockage, because the original capacity in the department was not able to process at a fast rate those numbers of applications that came in with those posts. But we've now employed that capacity and the process is much fast-tracked. But second to that is we adopted a retention strategy which aims to then curb the turnover rate and the people that exit the department, on the other hand, to substantial numbers. And that reduction around turnover as well has been quite a success in dealing with the issue of vacancies that are created by people exiting the department and leaving. That we've also raised as a particular challenge in the public service generally, because that does not occur only in the Department of Transport. Turnover rates and high levels of circulation in government and the public service are a particular challenge. We have tried to lobby extensively for particular restrictions to be imposed. For instance, in the recruitment of people, particularly in management positions, so that in fact when you have newly employed a person, they really should be discouraged from applying for another job within 6 months, because in essence, there's nothing that they can deliver in a 6 month period. And therefore what you have as a result is the de-skilling of individuals who generally job hop because of vacancy rates that exist in various departments. And that fluidity is a problem that exists in government, and we're still trying to find a solution collectively in the forum of directors general as to how to slow down mobility to an extent that allows specifically for people to gain experience when they are employed in positions. Because the tendency, somebody comes into transport, they become a director. They stay for 6 months, they see a chief director post in foreign affairs, they apply for it. They get employed, they shift, they are DDG the next time you find them, they are working in labor. Maybe they are DG the next 6 months, they are employed somewhere else. That is not healthy for the public service. But because we don't talk to each other as departments and say, don't recruit somebody with 6 months experience in a post, that fluidity is something that is inadvertently encouraged, and it's something that we intend to curb quite significantly. So at least you should say somebody employed in a post should be there for 2 years in order to say they've served, they've worked in that area, and they've gained experience in that area, gainfully employed, in order to be ready for a promotion to a next post. And those are really the challenges that we face around that. But we're quite happy with what we achieved. And largely, we are significantly happy that the department has stabilized at the rate of about 9%. We set a target for ourselves to halve the vacancy rate, which was at about 37% at the time we came to the committee, and we're supposed to be at 19% by end of December last year. We achieved and even exceeded that target, and in fact, at 9%, we see ourselves as quite a healthy percentage of vacancy. We would still endeavor, though, to fill the post completely. But there's always a 1 or 2%, up to 5% a vacancy rate that would apply in most instances and would consider that healthy. The second...
The second question to you is
that is this now plan that you put in front of us here, the strategic plan as such, based on the capacity that you envisage, that 1,000 versus the 610 you have at the moment, because it's going to come down to implementation, whether you'll be able to do this with what you have, and then how is Treasury now allowing you to phase this in? Are they going to give you like 100 posts a year for the next 10 years? Because you're looking for 1,000, you've got 610. So you're actually at 60% capacity in a sense. That's what I want.
Chairperson, I think the honourable member is absolutely correct. The rate at which we get finance to increase the organisational establishment is a function of Treasury discretion. It's not something that we have great influence over. Even though we indicate what we request, we are not always allocated what we request. So in essence, the original self-established over 1,000 is ideally what we need to be able to implement what we have. The challenge is it is getting funded on a progressive basis. But it is also true that the programs we have on our strategic plan are also not annual programs, but programs over the MTF period. So if we consider the MTF period, I would guess that at the end of the MTF period, we would have covered significantly the requirement for the self-establishment that was originally required. Not in the single financial year, but over a three-year period. And that will help us to get to the point at which we have substantially covered our requirements. Not fully, but substantially covered our requirements in capacity terms. Some of the capacity challenges, though, Chairperson, are not related to the National Department of Transport. In the nature of the programs that are contained in this very strategic plan, to a large extent, we depend on our agencies, we depend on provinces, we depend on municipalities for the successful implementation of the strategic plan. So the capacity assessment, therefore, should also be in relation to all those other tiers of government and the agencies, and we're quite happy with the status in the agencies. I think there would be concerns about other levels of government as well, provinces and municipalities, particularly municipalities and their ability to implement some of the programs. Our approach, though, in most of the programs which we implement, is really not to distance ourselves as a national department responsible for policy and strategy and leave implementation to other levels. We have an interventionist approach, we get involved, we guide, we go into both provinces and municipalities and set up joint teams between national, province, and local to implement programs so that you cover those gaps in instances where certain municipalities may not have the capacity themselves. So we're not a typical national department who sits there and says we are all about policy, we don't want to know anything else. We get our hands dirty, we're found in implementation, we guide and we move with speed in particular areas. The second question relates to the master plan. And what I would say, a short answer to that would basically indicate that the master plan is also done in conjunction with Transnet. And particularly incorporated would be the ports and rail master plan that relates to Transnet activity. Yes, of course we do have a challenge in relation to the institutional arrangements, which means we don't have proper oversight and policy intervention mechanism into the business of Transnet, principally because they account to the Department of Public Enterprises. That is a situation that we think needs to be resolved, and that situation needs to allow us more alignment so that the operations of what is a monopoly state-owned company in the area of ports and rail is guided by the department that is responsible for policy and operations in this area. The corporate business of Transnet surely remains the business of DPE, but their operations targets and other operations should really be related to transport. And the issue of the port regulator would also indicate...
Excuse me. What is the situation as this speak? Do they account to us or...
The situation as we speak, Honourable Chairperson, is they account to DPE.
Mm-hmm.
SAA also accounts to DPE. They do not account to this department. However, we interact with them on several issues on several areas. For instance, the newly established court regulator has started engaging with them around their particular operations and is starting to regulate their business. As the Department of Transport on the freight policy and strategy issues, we interact with them. The difficulty is that that interaction almost has to be on a tripartite basis with the Department of Public Enterprises. So we can never almost interact directly with Transnet. And yet, that is critical and that is necessary in order for us to have a particular influence on what it is that they do as their business. We always have to go via DPE, and whether DPE agrees or disagrees or can or cannot establish a meeting, our dependency on DPE is really, I think, a source of frustration in terms of interacting with Transnet. But that's who they report to, according to the law right now, and they have no reporting lines to ourselves. And that's basically the challenge. But we will indicate, in the area of freight and logistics, we will consistently indicate that this is a problem, and it's a problem that needs to be resolved. The business that we do in freight and logistics is not too complicated, it is complicated by this particular factor, more than anything else. I think road freight and other issues we handle quite well, but the rail freight and port operation side is really, really a challenging area because of this institutional problem. The next question about...
For example, access. If there's a problem at access, and I know they see to... Would they go through DPE, not to transport? Is that what you say?
No. AFSA is different. AFSA reports directly to the Department of Transport. We have full control. We're 100% shareholder. We're 90% shareholder. And they report to us on every matter. And you would see that the interaction with AFSA actually has no particular challenges at all.
Sorry, who is the shareholder of Transnet?
The shareholder is defined as DPE. The shareholder of Transnet is defined as the Department of Public Enterprises. The shareholder of AFSA is defined as the Department of Transport. The shareholder of PRASA is defined as the Department of Transport. The shareholder of SAA is defined as DPE, etc., etc. We can just give the schedule.
Yet, when the service is impacting negatively on the public doesn't
think
that
it's a public enterprise, they do the transport. Okay. Another point you see which raises this issue, and it's a very important one. There is no control over the tariffing of these institutions other than through the regulator to a point. But we want to get road onto rail, and yet they're running an inefficient service which is outpricing, and you respect some of the rail. That's why people take their cargo by road. And that is the dilemma that we sit with. So if we had control and oversight on that aspect of it, to try and make it competitive and to make it more attractive, our problem solved. So we need to look at that too.
Okay. You remember yesterday we said our approach in dealing with the question is going to be that of you as the admin telling us what causes the problems and challenges that you would want us to speak on. And we are identifying this as one of the thorny areas. How would you want to see the situation change? What change would you want to see happening as a result of our intervention, not only during the budget debate, but also taking into consideration that there is now a planning commission and also there is a monitoring committee which would depend on these issues for it to effect improvements that have been causing delays in service delivery. What is it that you would want to see us hammering as change that has to take place?
Thank you, Chairperson. With specific reference to this matter, there have been processes in government in the last month of the last term of office to attempt to make proposals for a realignment of functions in order to get things right in the new term of government. One of those proposals was to facilitate the transfer of Transnet and SAA to the Department of Transport and that they report directly to that department. A second proposal, which was discussed at least at the level of the Forum of Directors General, was a proposal that defined a restructuring mechanism for the Department of Public Enterprises, which would go along the following principle, that if an entity operated as a commercial company was competitive in the environment where they operated, had competitors and was not a monopoly, by definition, in a typical market economy like ours, it would have distinct unfair advantage if that entity was located in the line function department, because that advantage would basically disadvantage its competitors and would create unlevel playing field. The second proposition was that if an operator, on the other hand, was a monopoly, was 100% owned by the state, had no competitors in the environment, and had regulatory functions of one sort or another, they should be located in the line function department in order to align those functions with that of the department and facilitate better operations. Those two principles were put forward as a mechanism to guide the separation of entities and the realignment of entities with respect to the Department of Public Enterprise. I think the difference we would like to see is principally one that is guided by such principles, but effectively allows for monopoly companies to be located in line function departments, because what they are indeed is extensions and implementing arms of those departments. And yet, you would then take companies that are smaller in size, are commercial in orientation, and basically run business, and then you can have a Department of Public Enterprises, as it is defined, pulling those together and managing the corporate business of those type of companies, but not state monopolies, because by definition, those should be located in line function departments. That's the change, Jefferson, we would like to see, and principally, it would mean Transnet more, because Transnet also has a really big problem. A lot of the functions in Transnet are regulatory. In the port area, they regulate and they are operators. Now that can never be fair in any market. It's either you separate those regulatory functions and they go back to transport and you keep the commercial operation part at another level, but restructuring of Transnet is absolutely critical. It just means the playing fields are not level and they haven't been for a very long time. And an intervention in that area, we would think, is long overdue. In order to just create a level playing field for other operators, we, through the National Trade Logistics Strategy, have been promoting competition in this environment because we do not believe that Transnet can continue to be the only state monopoly. It does not augur well for good service provision to continue operating a state monopoly that also plays a role of regulator. What you need is mechanisms which are clearly stipulated in our trade logistics strategy that opens out that market and allows private sector to participate so that you can improve service delivery to our people and you can broaden the network of services, and it's not going to be guided by the bottom line and the profit margins of one single organization, which is currently the situation.
Are members satisfied with the response? Thank you.
Yeah.
Can we then get to the next question that's from Honorable Deflators? They relate to the foul train and the overspending and road accident fund.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
And in the meantime, we are serving ourselves with tea.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. A very simple, short answer to foul train integration. The Gauteng project was started by the Gauteng province. When they discovered that the financial model required additional funding, they approached the national government to assist funding it, so it became a national project. The condition of that funding was that it would be integrated into the network and would not be a single line Gauteng project in a province. The condition also was that the alignment of stations, platforms, and the track would have to be in line with the metro rail services that currently operate in the same area and jurisdiction. So what does integration mean in the Gautrain example? It means, one, at Park Station, we integrate the Gautrain station with the metro rail operations. We would have ideally liked to have them on a platform-to-platform sharing, but that was not achievable because Gautrain emerges at Park Station underground and not at the same level as the others. So that was a physical problem that could not be overcome. But we've created the infrastructure to create the link at Park Station in order to allow for that. At all other stations, the integration has been done on a cross-platform level. So in fact, you come out of the Gautrain on one track, you have a platform, you come into a metro rail station. That has occurred in Roadfield, in Centurion, in Pretoria Central, and in Hatfield, where the other major stations are. So by definition, that alignment has meant the station operations are now single. Roadfield is now both a Gautrain station coming out of the airport and the metro rail station. And that's what integration means. It allows people who are coming from Tshwane or coming from the East Rand on that line to jump onto the Gautrain at a particular point. So therefore, by definition, integration does not mean interoperability and therefore does not impact on the track width requirements. Gautrain is the first example of a wide gauge train or track in South Africa. It is the only one, but a decision, a policy decision has been taken that any further new rail development will be done on the wide gauge basis, and similar integrative mechanisms will be put in place to ensure that we're able to integrate the new system with the old. So you can't run a metro rail train on the Gautrain track, you can't run Gautrain on a metro rail track, but at stations, you are able to basically offload people on the same platform and load them onto the other. And that's what we've managed to achieve. And the other important integrative mechanism is the issue of ticketing, which is integrated. We've created a single platform, and that platform is a platform that operates for all integrated ticketing mechanisms that are to come in the future. Taxis, buses, rail, Gautrain, all on the same platform, which means the smart card technology base is the same, and it allows for interoperability on each other's systems. And that is how we facilitated integration with respect to that. Can I ask Mr. Nkwalo to respond to the second question on the motor vehicle accident?
Before that, there is a follow-up.
Thank you.
Sorry, I just need to understand this because it's a great concern to me, this different tracks. Am I reading between the lines that you're saying that in the long term, you're going to be doing away with the old tracks and putting in the wire tracks, or is it going to be a mixture of both? And I'm asking from a mechanical, practical side, is it practical to have two systems, although they will be the same station physically and so forth, does it make sense to have two different sets of tracks?
Mm-hmm. If you go back to the original proposals that were put to this committee, Chair, and I think you need to get a copy of it, it was a very good report. We were very much against the use of dual or two different systems of tracks or gauge, for the simple reason that we felt that the whole feasibility of Caltrain could be more sustainable if there was a combined operation and integration of Metrorail onto those services when it was running off peak. I think you need to read that report. It was quite an extensive report from this committee. And I understand this whole change of gauge into the new system now, which has taken us away from integration as far as I'm concerned. I disagree with the DG entirely on this matter, because I really feel strongly about it. We have got a set of protocols that we've actually signed, and we haven't seen in this committee yet, to say that we are going to build every future railway line in this country that involves commuter trail is going to be at the wider gauge. And here we're going to sit with a different system running in parallel, which we can't ever at any stage look at doing this with, if we had to try and fulfill some of the movements of people along those lines. Now, I think we need to look at that protocol, and let's have a look at it.
Okay. I want to understand the issue here. Okay. The country was running on a narrow gauge track, and as a result, we could not have fast moving train. That then had an impact in terms of time spent by people moving from one area to the next. The Gautrain is a wide gauge rail. It's moving on a wide gauge rail, resulting with the situation where the time spent on the train is shortened. Okay. But as an interim measure, because that is what I am understanding from where I am sitting. I was not part of the committee, I was not in the department. Whilst you are piloting, because I would think that the Gautrain is a pilot project, whilst you are piloting through Gauteng, how to improve the rail system in South Africa, well, you would then integrate the old system to the new system, because you wouldn't have enough resources to change all the rail lines that are on the narrow gauge. So the best for you to do is to integrate the old and the new. And in the process of building the new, you do away with the narrow rail. And when the funds permit you to change the old narrow gauge, you do so. That is how I understand the whole thing. I now want to understand the committee's perspective on that. How does it differ from what I am reading from what is being done at departmental level?
Chair, I think we must get the report in pages. I think I can bring you a copy next time we sit here. But our viewpoint was totally different to what the DG is saying. In terms of integration, and the minister has stood up and said this over and over again, he wanted to see this thing integrated. Now, the only way you can integrate is by able to utilize and cross-utilize the services that we have in this country of rail, which is a massive investment. We're talking this little strip between Oliver Tambo and Sandton, and the other one from Pretoria to Sandton, representing, you know, nothing more than about 1 or 2% of our total rail network in this country. Mm-hmm. Now, if you think of the cost implication of every time we now go into a new rail, we're going to put a wider gauge. It's going to, at the end of the day, cost this country a fortune, so I don't think you'll even find the funds for ultimately. The reason behind the wider gauge was purely as a result of the bid that went out and the fact that the supplier, Bombardier, were able to supply those in knockdown forms in that particular size and gauge. And that is the truth of the matter. The bottom line is that if that unit or that particular train service between Pretoria and Sandton is not sustainable, and there's a very high possibility of your ridership not being reached there of 100,000, the chances are very likely that you're going to have a white elephant there which you cannot actually integrate then other services on. We already have a metro rail services between Pretoria and Johannesburg, which is actually running at about a third of the price. Now, the question that comes up with this whole gauge matter is, you mentioned speed. Now, there is proof, and at our public hearings, when this thing was brought up, Metro Rail actually had trains running at about 160 kilometers an hour on their current network. Current network. They approved that to us, they showed it to us, so there was no reason to say that the reason for the wider gauge was purely speed. It was because of the type of train that was ordered in terms of the tender and the bid. That is what I'm... And the report will show this to you. We have public hearings over this matter. So I see a lot of shaking of heads down. From a technical perspective, let me tell you, Chief, that I think it was a very, very bad move. And that's my personal opinion as an engineer. And I have just consulted widely with many, many engineering consultants in this matter, and they all say the same thing. It's the worst thing that we've done here. And I understand it might be linked to the fact that there was a protocol signed by SADC to say that in SADC region, if there ever is going to be another railway line built, it's got to be built now at this wide range. But to satisfy importers or providers of train sets from overseas, I call it. Let's not go there, we'll bring the report in the court.
Okay. Can we park this? It is going to take a lot of time and discussion. We will revisit that report as a committee and familiarize ourselves with it, and then bring, like, if we are saying Gauteng is a pilot project, no matter how it was done, we have to use it now as a pilot project moving forward. We will then have to treat it that way to actually say what are the advantages and disadvantages of the Gautrain in terms of upgrading the railway network in South Africa. And which then means that we will have to revisit the reports, but also monitor the implementation process and the impact of the Gautrain. And also, look at what is happening in other countries, because it is not only that we would base our judgment on what the portfolio committee or on the third parliament portfolio committee arrived at their report. We will also move forward by interacting with other countries and see what is happening in those countries. So let us pack it for now and move to the next question. Yeah. All we are saying is that we will bring back all the documents that would assist us to understand and move forward, and also we will do our own study on this and come up with recommendations and whatever in terms of improving the transport system. Remember, we're not talking Gautrain only. We're talking railway Transnet in South Africa and railway Transnet that leaves South Africa to the SADC country. So, can we then take the next question?
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Member. I'm going to attempt to answer the question on the overexpenditure of 6.5 million accident claim. It's quite a complicated case that has been there since 1997. In the case, one Ms. Jeffrey Dutoy sued the minister as a defendant. and Toll Road Concession, PTY Limited, as a first third party, and the second third party was a certain Mr. Johannes Tutoi, who also happened to be the husband, for negligence. The case, apparently the accident happened around Krasnaya Toll Road. She sued the department for a lack of clear road signage and also culminating out of that the husband for reckless driving. Now, the court found in the favor of Ms. Tutoi, but then decided to apportion this in the level of negligence. In that case, what had happened is that they had found 80% negligence was caused by the husband, 15% negligence was caused by the toll road concession for not maintaining the signage, and 5% negligence in the side of the minister for not actually checking whether toll road concession had actually maintained the road signs. Now, when the judge found that, we tried to appeal. Still, they found in Mr. Choi's favor. Now, we were supposed to apportion this amount in the same respect. Actually, they have sued for 30,369,000 and some odd. But then the agreement was that 6.5 million had to be paid. So the settlement was for 6.5 million. There was also a court order which determined that in terms of Section 2.1 of the Apportionment of Damages Act of number 34 of 1956, if you are a defendant in a case and so happens that there is a bit of negligence that you are found and there are other parties, then you are forced to pay that and claim the amount from the other parties. And that's how it came that we were forced by a court order to then pay the 6.5 million, of which the 5.2 million we must claim from the husband and the 975,000 from Toll Road Concession, being 95% of the whole amount, and then we are supposed to pay, our liability was only for 325,000. I hope this has resolved the issue.
There is something that I would want to understand that relates to that. Besides the claims and what have you, how much is also spent on court fees, which for me would be an issue, and how much time also is spent on cases instead of maintenance of the signage that would then prevent an accident from occurring and then prevent us from spending time in court and then in lawyer's fees.
The first approach that government would take on matters where, for instance, I would understand when honorable members say this was the matter for the road accident fund, and you would at the initial stage think that this is a matter for the road accident fund, and therefore the challenge that we have in challenging that is because we don't want to set precedent. Because once you have set precedent, then people are going to use that precedent, and you've got to have litigation after litigation after litigation because of the precedent. And I think the approach of trying to defend this was coming from that basis, to say, these are matters that are handled by the Road Accident Fund, and therefore, in that respect, we thought that that matter should be handled like that. But the court obviously disagreed, and that's why we even went for appeal. That was in order to determine that we don't have to set precedent for ongoing litigation that will come the minister's way.
That is not the question. That is not the question. The question is, we have an overspending. and it is linked to road accident fund. And how we arrive at that, the first thing that permits us to have a case is road maintenance. If the roads were maintained, we would not have an accident, and therefore we would not, whether it was the road accident fund or whoever, if we had a good road maintenance strategy, we would not have that. And then, we would not spend time, and time is money, dealing with the case. We would not spend money on legal costs, and then at the end of the day, we would also not spend money paying and then also claiming, which diverts our attention from what we are for. We are for service delivery. We are not for cost settlement. Our approach is to minimize accidents, and as a result of that, spend less time in court and spend more time maintaining the rules. Now, when the issue of overspending is being raised by the committee, it relates to that. Tell us how much in total, including the legal costs and everything, so that we can see which is cheaper to do. Between prioritizing maintenance of the road and then going to court and defend cases.
I understood to say that this is in a concession toll area. Is that correct? Who is the concessionaire? Is it a private-public partnership or is it SANRAL? Because under those circumstances, you're paying tolls at the gate specifically for ensuring that you have a safe ride between A and B, where there are barriers and where there are road signs there. Therefore, the liability is not the department's liability, Madam Chair. I believe it is the concessionaire's liability. And for them to not maintain, after taking money at the toll gate for innocent drivers who think they're going through that toll on a safe road, to me, is absolutely mind-boggling. Please, can you answer that?
Honourable Chairperson, I think what is vexing in this particular case is not the issue of where liability should be ascribed. We all agree that firstly it's in a concession area and there's a company called Tollcon that is responsible for this. The challenge is if you are listed in a case as a respondent, first, second, third, or fourth, the liability is done on a joiner. And by definition, all the parties, the husband, Tollcon, and the department, the spouse and the department, are all responsible for what is then ascribed as a claim at the end. Now, the way the court order has been structured, and this is the legal technicality, the way the court order has been structured, it suggests that one party should pay and claim from the other. And that is what we can challenge. But by definition, we had to budget for that particular issue. We can challenge that as a court order and take the process forward to recover those costs from the concession company, from the husband. The only challenge with the husband is we're informed that he's bankrupt and won't be able to pay his costs. But it's really a legal case we must still fight in order to bring it to conclusion. Because in essence, it's the joiner, what they call a joiner legally, which is creating the problem for us, which joins severally all of the respondents in the responsibility to pay. We would claim the money back from the concessionaire as well, as the husband, as everybody else who's involved in the case. In the end, you would probably see the department as the facilitator of the settlement with the responsibility of then claiming back from the various parties. That's almost the way it would happen in practice. And it's a joiner issue which puts us in this predicament. And it has, unfortunately, legal precedent going back Chairperson, your direct question, in my understanding, is that you are asking a broader question,
mm-hmm.
not about this case,
mm-hmm.
but about cases of this nature generally.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like to respond to that in writing and provide you with that information, because we've not pulled it together because we do not anticipate such a question. We can prepare that for you, come back and say, total legal costs over financial year have been X, the number of cases have been Y, they relate to matters such as road maintenance and these other kinds of issues, and therefore answer the question that says, why are we spending time in courts instead of actually doing the investment which prevents us from being sued in particular cases? And that information we can provide. I'm sure none of us here have it. It would be in our legal section and we can get that for you.
Thank you, Chair, but there is a bigger question which is related to the three powers. We're gradually finding, just from where we sit, where the judiciary is beginning to overturn what the legislature is doing. That people who don't get what they can at the legislature, then suddenly run to the judiciary. And the judiciary suddenly changes legislation that has been made by Parliament. And that becomes problematic for us as well. But it's a bigger problem which we cannot discuss.
No. It is not an issue that can, there is no issue that cannot be discussed in Parliament,
mm-hmm.
and it has to do with the power and function. We wouldn't want the judiciary to become legislators in the same way that they wouldn't want us to become the judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
So there is separation of powers. Why we are asking this question? They relate to the budget vote in terms of understanding the over expenditure, but they also relate to the broader issues of transformation in this country and areas of responsibility, whether we are going to continuously spend money fighting cases that were not going to be there if we had a very good plan on road maintenance and what have you. And also, the fact that there are companies that are doing work for us, but at the end of the day, the egg on the face will go to the government, not the companies, meaning that at this level, we need to set monitoring and evaluation systems that allow us to terminate the concession if the companies that are charged with this responsibility are not performing, because we cannot be part of a situation where the delivery is questionable because the companies that are given the work to do are not performing. So there is no value for money. Instead, we find ourselves in a situation where we have to spend money on areas that we are not supposed to spend it on if those people were doing the work. So that is what we would want to discuss. That the report must take us to that process where we come to a situation of what do we do when a person or a service provider has been given work to do and they are not doing it to the satisfaction of this country. Next question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Shovagalula, Chairperson, we would maybe also like one day to invite members and expose members to what we do when we launch Shovagalula, when we go into communities and all of that. But let me ask
Can I simplify the question? The question is, Shovagalula responds to a need, and we are all in agreement with that. But the implementation part of it is not well coordinated, in a sense that it's like giving computers to a school that is not electrified. The bicycles are given, the roads are not there. That is what, that is the question.
Chairperson, when we embark in a Shobhagamina project, we go into a particular area and do an assessment. We then find the appropriate schools in that area in order to select the pupils or the learners that walk more than 5 kilometers. The program does not only include the issuing of bicycles. It includes the development of bicycle tracks in those areas, even though that infrastructure program, we acknowledge, is slower than needs to be. But effectively, we move into a community and do the following things. We select the schools, we select the children, we give the bicycles, we set up a maintenance container, which maintenance container is employs a local person who basically will maintain the bicycle. Afterwards, we start a project of developing bicycle tracks between the school and villages where basically the pupils are traveling from. And that program is not as well funded, the infrastructure part is not as well funded as it is. So what it requires us to do is to twin two components on the infrastructure funding side together with the bicycle program. The second challenge that we face with Shobhagalula, we highlighted yesterday in our presentation, is that of bicycle manufacturing capacity in South Africa. The bicycles are still expensive because they are assembled in South Africa. They are not built here. And what we're looking for is to promote business opportunities for the bicycles to be manufactured here and therefore serviced, and we create business opportunities through the same manufacturing of bicycles. Our target, Chairperson, for Shobhagalula were very ambitious as we turned the program around, and we thought we'd deliver 1 million bicycles in 5 years. Because we do treat this as our poverty alleviation, second economy intervention program, which is very important in rural areas. It guarantees education for children. The challenge we've had is the allocations from Treasury yet again, which have been far below what we have requested in order to meet that 1 million target. So we're moving slowly on this project, but also the alignment of that funding for the bicycles and the infrastructure funding, which is also very limited. But we move at the pace that we can. So if we say we'll deliver 15,000 in a year, our original target would have been to do at the rate of about 200,000 a year. So 15,000 is nearly a drop compared to what we would have liked to do. But we're guided by the fiscal allocation we get on a program-by-program basis, which is also driven by affordability at that level. But we do, well, they do bicycle tracks on gravel and set them aside, and then they do road safety education as well, because the importance around bicycle use is also issues of safety. The children are given helmets, they are given jackets, safety jackets and all of that, and they are trained in using the tracks. And the tracks are actually very simple infrastructure. On the normal gravel road, you build a border. You actually have people employed in a kind of EPWP way where they almost dig a little trench, which is then the bicycle track, and they line it with bricks so that it's on the side of the road. And the children are trained in using that bicycle track, in crossing the road, in ensuring their safety. Because we can't introduce a method of movement without ensuring its proper use and its safety in its use. But I must acknowledge, would like to do more on the infrastructure side. It's just the funding allocation is quite limited.
Mary, if I could just ask, Madam Chair, if when you're preparing our committee's plan and so forth, I would love to see this in action. Because I have reservations, but I'd love to see it, because it sounds like a great idea, but I can see all sorts of shortfalls, and I'm not a rural person. So it would be very interesting just to see the whole thing. Thank you.
We're inviting the committee, and that's really what I'm trying to do here, because we've been along this path before, and those of you that will record, about 10 years ago, the late Dulu Home Minister then of Transport took us to Amsterdam, and we had a week there of looking at various methods, of which one of them was, in fact, bringing out bicycles from the Netherlands, which were donations and to be given to us by the container load, that is it. Now, I don't know whether that was ever received, had. If those bicycles were ever received and refurbished and sort of the ones that we are now dishing out, or we're talking new bikes now, of which we don't have capacity for, from what I understand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a very important issue with bicycles, because if you're in the rural areas and you see 4 o'clock in the morning when children go to get up and walk to school, then you realize why it is. The other point that is very interesting, I think manufacturing the bicycles in South Africa will immediately create jobs. And I think we should encourage this by all means.
Thank you, Father. If they were not delivered, these bicycles, we can just as well go and find out why they were not delivered.
Okay. You know, I'm not interested on the ones that were delivered or what. I'm more focused on the future. I would like to see the linkage of Shovagalula to poverty reduction, where we would be able to say, through this project, this is how we would impact on poverty reduction, because 2014 is just around the corner, and targets were set that this country would reduce poverty by 50%, which means each and every department had to sit down and identify how the programs that are implemented by each department or project would then reduce poverty, by what percentage and by when. And also identify areas, because when that was announced of reducing poverty by 50% by 2014, already there were presidential poverty nodal points that were identified in this country. So we would want to see the link. When pronouncements are made by the president, those pronouncements are actually meant to direct the focus of each and every person in the country, government departments in particular. So what we would want to see is, yes, the Shovagalula, we are in agreement with it, but the Shovagalula should demonstrate to us how it is going to move us towards the reduction of poverty by 50% by 2014. So we must see, and also it must demonstrate to us areas that are targeted. Are we delivering in areas where it is easy to deliver, or we are targeting the presidential poverty nodal point? Number three, there is an act that was passed in 2005, Cooperative Development Act. How does the Shovagalula assist poverty-stricken communities through the cooperative development to participate in the program? Is there a link, is there an attempt to link the poor communities to say, you can establish cooperatives, we know of a country that is good in manufacturing bicycles, we can get technicians to come and teach you, and we have a market for you, because we have this project of Shovagalula, which can then provide you with opportunities of access. And then at policy level now, formulate a policy that is going to open opportunities for those people, because for as long as there is no policy that opens opportunities for cooperatives that are established in that nature for a particular purpose, they will be there, but they will not access any opportunities. So we are policy makers. If we want to turn around this country, the social conditions and the economic conditions of this country, let us have policies that are going to open those opportunities. There is no department that I have seen, maybe I still have to come across a department that has set how much of the services that are procured from the department are reimbursed for cooperatives. Not a single department, yet there is an act, and we know that poor people and in all throughout the world, cooperatives are the most powerful tool of changing the social and the economic conditions of the poor people. Yet we don't have policies that are actually giving those people an opportunity to participate. There is no ring fencing. We don't say whether 30% of all the services that are procured from the department will go to the cooperatives. And if we don't say that, nothing will happen. Cooperatives will be registered. They will appear in the CIPO register, but they will not access any opportunities because we don't open those opportunities for them. So that is how we would want to see. Give us the report, but also give us the turnaround strategy that relates to what we have mentioned, poverty reduction, cooperative development, job creation, crime reduction, because some of the people that are absorbed by crime are actually people that would not have been there if there were job opportunities. So we will not combat crime by having gamma street committees only, by building jails and having more police. We will also deal with the social problems that result with people having no jobs and end up getting involved in crime. Can we move to the next set of questions?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just quickly, Chairperson, on the anti-poverty strategy. In the presentation yesterday, we specifically indicated that the anti-poverty strategy, which is led in the presidency, has various components, including grants, and so Vagalula has one of those grants. So we give bicycles in the context. But we'll bring back a report to show you the contribution and the detail around the issues that you've raised, and the nodal point reviews in the rural areas we've identified, and all of that. The next question deals with the road accident, or rather the train accident. And I think the Honorable Member was asking a question around what causes a train accident collision. Very simply put, and a quick answer to that is, trains do not only run on a single dedicated track. On many instances, they switch tracks in order to get into a particular area and take a particular route. And the challenge that we've had, which has contributed somewhat to train accidents, has been the issue of signaling. The signaling system on the South African railway system is old, and we've allocated money for the first time in the last financial year to do the signaling system upgrading so that we modernize it, bring up the technology to particular levels, and at least from a perspective of the Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa, we have started with the signaling upgrading program, which also includes the track upgrading and infrastructure upgrading along the lines, which enables us to then deal with some of the challenges that may contribute to train collision. So what normally happens is, if a train is running on a track, at the point at which it's meant to switch over to another track, the signal does not stop the other train at a particular point, and that's how a collision happens in most instances. And that's something we're working on. It's a program that's probably going to take us about 5 years to complete the signaling upgrading across the system, but we're making significant progress. I must indicate that the challenge is that the previous allocations to the Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa were focusing specifically on the rail refurbishment, the coach refurbishment program, and not the infrastructure and signaling, up until a year and a half when we decided to change that situation and get treasury allocation specifically for signaling. So as part of the entire refurbishment and rail turnaround program, those investments are now being made, and we're making significant progress in those areas. And that will minimize accidents and time. Again, the other challenge is FARCC, which is a component of the Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa, owns the infrastructure and runs it. Principally, it becomes our responsibility, even in relation to the Transnet issues. The problem we have, coming back to the Transnet problem, is the issues related to access and prioritization of freight rail systems on the track rather than passenger rail on the track. And that's a challenge because, as we go back to the original discussion we had, because we do not have Transnet under the control of Transport, Transnet, however, controls access issues onto the track, and that creates a particular problem. And that's almost a regulatory function of Transnet, which shouldn't be in the hands of a single operator, as I was relating to earlier.
Okay.
yesterday, we were going to say, I think, there was a terror accident in Washington, D.C. yesterday. First world country. So is that a similar reason as to what you, if it was being to signaling or something like that? Yesterday, there was an accident, train accident in Washington, D.C. Yeah, on the train tracks. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a first world country, and we would expect they're meant to have signaling, you know, those types of things in their country. So would it be linked maybe to the same reason as to South Africa, you know, because I don't expect something to happen in such a country like that.
Honorable Chairperson, the response through you is, yes, in fact, this was the case, apparently signaling. But can I ask Mr. Suma, who's aware of the details, to just expand on that? But it's a similar problem. Even in the first world country, it happens.
Honorable Chairperson and member, yes, it was failure of the signalizing system that allowed two trains to have a head-on collision at peak hours in the Washington, D.C. area. Now, what happens is that even in the modern signalization, there is what you call the block control of trains, which says if you go through one green light, one red light, you automatically are stopped at the second one or at the third one. That's a block signalization that we have developed it to. Now, in our country, we do not even have that technology yet. And as a result of that, the signals do not respond to the train wave that triggers the control of the signals. So that is the result of why you get failing in urban areas. And it also is very, very predominant in areas whereby the signals are operating on a different wave. Like when you have a single signal to stop the train instead of a block signal, then the chances of having an accident are very, very high when you have one signal control establishment that we have in this country.
Before we stopped, we had asked five questions, and I thought all these were follow-ups and to those five questions, and I am now opening for the second set of questions, but we will not take five because of time. We will only take one, and the member which was on the line for that question was Honorable Nirod, and then followed by Honorable Lucas. We will take those questions, even if we don't respond to them now. We will break and go to the house and then respond to them. If there are other members that would want to pose questions so that when we come with them, respond to the questions, I also have them. Honorable Neva.
Thank you, Chairperson. Last week, I asked a question regarding disability. I'm hoping that I get a response from that, maybe in a letter or something, and was about access to all transport. That is important to all modes of transport access for disabled people, please. And then I want to say something about the signage. If we are traveling, for example, I just come back from Washington, D.C., and I traveled to the metro there. They have lines where it will say, I'm going to the southern suburbs or I'm going to the northern suburbs. They show visual, the colors. They will show colors. Okay, the signage is done in colors. So I will know for what train, what side I must be, or what platform I must get on or get off. Now, in Cape Town, I've been stuffed. People will say they don't know what platform they need to go on. Let me give an example. Cape Town to Simon is done. I know the train line by sight. I know where I need to go. Simon coming back, I know what platform to take. So now in 2011, we will be having a lot of visitors who don't speak English. And they will obviously use our train lines. And there's no signage that will create a problem. For example, going from one destination to another destination. Okay, if I'm in one destination and I want to go back to another destination, I need to know, what am I going up or am I going down? Okay? And if I need to go, if I'm going up, fine, I need to go that way. If I'm going to go down, I must go across the platform. I must go on the other side of the platform. So, preparation for 2011, my own question is linked to signage. That's my question. Visible, that's important. Visibility is important. As one gentleman was saying yesterday, many of us South Africans don't read at the stadiums, so they get lost. They can't go to the car, can't find a taxi, so they get lost. So what, you know, and the language again is a problem. Or symbols, let's use symbols for signage that we as look, what can we know that visually impaired people, those types of things need to take into consideration. So what are you doing regarding the signage? The signs are extremely, they are not visible, they are not put in appropriate places. People, I come and get off in the station and I don't know where I am and I have to look around for the signage. So that's important. That's, yeah. I just want to know CBRT, cross border. CBRT, why is there such a little amount given? Okay, I see 437, is it million or billion year? I'm not too sure. Why is such a little allocated to the cross border sector here? That's my question there. That all? Oh, I've got a lot of questions here, but I'll stop. Okay, that's fine. Okay. Honorable Lucas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my one question is about the road back to the front, but from a different, a very different angle. Because most of the people that have suffered and who need to claim are poor people in most cases, because they go in companies and there are more people in the vehicle. But I have my reservations about the way they go about claiming, because I firmly believe that there are times when lawyers do take them for a ride. Because at the end of the day, they receive the bulk of the claim, because that people have to pay. And I'm not sure how we're going to sort that one. The other one is that one needs to look at the taxi recapitalization and the bus rapid transport system. I think we've got to sort this out almost immediately, because we're going for 2010. And if we haven't settled it down shortly, we're going to end up in a disaster. I can assure you, because the closer you get to the point, the stronger you make the taxi industry. So we have to sort it out. The last one is, I think, for example, from Pongola to Richards Bay, there's no toll there. But you can, if you go that road, the number of heavy vehicles which is destroying those roads, and they come out, they go off the road just before the toll. So there's no way. They're licensing their vehicles in Swaziland. So we're not deriving anything from this yet. What can we do about this?
Honorable. Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps let me begin by passing a remark that the department has given us a lot of paperwork. I don't know whether the attempt is to drown us in paperwork or to hide some deficiency somewhere. But I must admit that...
Can I explain that? Okay. We are a new committee, and the department was invited to give us all the information that relate to how the department is structured, how many branches are there, who is working in the department, doing what. That was one area, because we are all new. So they were not hiding anything. What they gave us is what we asked for. Maybe there is an uneven level of understanding from the members that are in the committee as to why that information. And I will keep on explaining. It's the information that we will use for the duration of 5 years, as long as we are here, because it gives us an understanding of how the department is structured, what does it do. You can take your time reading it. And then, after that, we will then zoom into each branch and each entity that reports to the department, as well as those entities that we feel should be reporting to the department. So don't be threatened by the documents. They are not meant to hide anything. In actual fact, they are meant to assist us understand the department better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I found it interesting in the presentation of the department that as it relates to issues of deficiency, the only time an issue of deficiency was reflected was as it relates to the issue of budget challenges and unfunded mandates. But coming to questions specifically, when presentation was made as it relates to 2010, I can write to be specific. It was reflected that in the first game, the amount of time that was utilized in terms of transporting people was 1 hour, 30 minutes. In the second game, 2 hours, and the third game, 1 hour. But you did not articulate specifically as it relates to figures, particularly if you dealt with the 1 hour part. Because that could be misleading, because it gives us the impression that there is an amount of progressiveness. Whereas sometimes it must just be because the numbers had declined. Thanks.
Also, I would want to assist in the area of asking questions. That is, when we approach questions, we should not try and arrive at a perception as to why this information was given in this particular fashion, because it will detract us from seeing what we are supposed to see and deal with issues that we need to be dealing with. Let us refrain from that, because it will detract our focus. Don't try and think why they are giving this information in this particular session. Move them to where you want them to be. And you have seen during these 2 days that the style is completely different from the style of the former chairperson, because it's a new committee. And they have also commented on that, and they have said, you are assisting us as this new committee. So let us understand that our responsibility is different from theirs. They cannot evaluate and monitor themselves. We evaluate and hold them accountable. So they will give us the information of how things are happening, and we have to talk to them about what we see as a gap, without judging them as to why they are doing that. Because we sit from different perspectives when we look at things. They are reporting about what is currently happening. We are scrutinizing that as to whether it is moving us towards the direction which we want to be, and we then recommend to them the improvements that we would want to see. Let us break, because the bells are ringing, and then we will reconvene at half past 12. Thank you very much.